management techniques that were truly new to PARC at the time, and they were truly necessary. So I'm Charles Simoni, and I got to PARC because I worked at Berkeley Computer Corporation with Peter and Bartle Lampson and Chuck Thacker, and I was a student at Berkeley. Berkeley Computer Corporation went bankrupt, and Bob Taylor, who was working with the professors there at Berkeley Computer through ARPA, hired the whole bunch to start PARC in a act of great foresight. And I was kind of a hanger-on, an undergraduate, still didn't have my undergraduate degree. In fact, I was a foreign student on an F-1 visa without a valid passport, on the edge of deportation, literally. And basically, I without a work permit. So much of the wizardry work was accomplished at quarter time, practically as an illegal alien. But fortunately, I had another quarter of my time was spent at the ILIAC 4 project. And if you go to the floor, you will see some pieces of the ILIAC 4, and they probably still have my thumbprints on the buttons on the console. And the ILIAC, of course, was also called the Vietnam of computer science. And it was a computer with so many bugs and so difficult to debug, and so retro, it's unbelievable. But it accomplished a very important task, which is to prevent my deportation. So I'm very grateful. The moment I got my green card in 75, which was after the second version of Bravo, I had to call the ILIAC project and say that sorry, I got my green card, I'm out of here. So those were that was my access to PARC, and it was indeed a wonderful place in many ways. And I just want to say one thing about the architecture that you described, and we saw Butler's memo, which is, I mean, it's an incredible document. It's so modern. It's one of those documents that are old in their age, but read in a completely modern way. And just to mention one example, the square pixels. The IBM PC, of course, started with non-square pixels, and it took them until 87 or 88 before they got onto square pixel. But I want to say something. I just want to say something different about. Incredibly surprising, and I mean, it's an outstanding performance, is the performance from Chuck Thacker. Namely, here we had an engineer who actually did the architecture that was essentially a software architecture. And John, you were emphasizing the fact that the machine was software driven, which is very true. But I'd like to also rephrase that a little bit and say that it was a machine for the software. It was designed for the software. And probably for the first time, it introduced this concept, not explicitly, but implicitly, called separation of concerns, which now we in the industry, we really believe in that. And what I mean by that, you have to put yourself back to that era. Before the Alto, for example, the most popular terminal was the 3270 by IBM. And all of these hardware artifacts had many very aggressive engineers behind them who really wanted to make their hardware the best in the world, the most features, really help the user. So the hardware people would actually so-called study the user, look at the requirements, and then build the exact hardware that would answer those requirements. And that was, of course, in some sense, it makes sense, You know, it's like the central, it's the same nonsense as the idea of central planning. That, you know, the best way to do cars is that we have a committee and then we study people's needs and then we build a car that exactly meets people's needs. The problem is that the engineers were just too busy and doing everything wrong. They were spending too much time studying the users and didn't spend enough time on the resolution, on the how flat the screen is, how cheap the screen is, you know, whether it can be color, new technologies of displaying things. So what the separation of concerns means is that Chuck Stecker said that I'm going to give you bits, and now everything is in your hands. Are you going to use it for Chinese characters? Are you going to use it for Cookie Monsters? Are you going to use it for justified text, for blinking text, for I don't know what? Basically, every configuration of bits on the screen was acceptable. And now the hardware guy can go away and make things better. And if we look, for example, just the display technology since then. By the way, the same thing is true for the keyboard. The keyboard was a non-decoded keyboard. We basically got bits from the keyboard saying the state of the particular keys. And that made it possible, for example, Smalltalk to people to do keyboard, play music on the keyboard or reprogram the keys, use different shift keys. You could do basically anything you wanted because you didn't have to bag the hardware engineer that was really a very difficult person to. They always had these great arguments of why they can't do things, which were generally also true. So this step of Chuck Thacker saying, "Hey, I'm going to contribute by making things simpler," I think was instead of making things better, which was just a word. It really didn't make things better when the engineers said that they were making things better. So Chuck Thacker kind of stepping back and saying that things are going to be simpler. I'm going to make this really good, and John making it more reliable and more ubiquitous and less expensive. You know, the price curve had to go down when the numbers were going up. First we had build of 5, and then we build of about 50. Then the next build was 2,000. So that was very interesting. So that's one of the things and I will say another short thing, but just Chuck Thacker's attitude to software, I think, was one of the greatest changes in this history. The other interesting turning point for me came was when I saw secretaries and spouses come in at night using the system, using computers. We are talking about civilians. I don't think anybody has ever seen civilians using computers on their own accord before. And people were, for example, Butler's wife, Lois, was doing her thesis at that time. This was in 74. At that time, when you wrote a PhD thesis, it was in biotech, by the way. It wasn't called biotech at the time, but it was immunology. So she was writing the thesis. When you started to write a PhD thesis, of course, the first thing you did was hire a typist. Am I? Do you remember that? Yeah. So you hired a typist. She was doing her own thesis on a computer. Unbelievable. Spouses were coming in, writing PTA newsletters. Unbelievable. People self-publishing. Newsletters, 1974, 75. People were writing, of course, letters to home. Hey, mom, look, and using all the different fonts, including black letter font, and we had a special font for the Xerox logo. So you had just X, you know, XERO in that font. Because it was so big, there was no font scaling, so it had to be big, and, you know, the space was at a premium, so we only had those few letters. So this change from computers being a laboratory equipment that would break, that you could break, and people were still afraid of it. I remember people coming to me and said that Charles, I broke the machine. And I said, no, it's a bug, you know, let me go fix it. They said, and they showed me, and they said, well, I must have broken it because every time I do such and such, it displays Chinese and it displays garbage. So obviously it's her action that caused the system to fail. And in some sense, they were right. But they felt guilty about breaking the machine, because at that time, the idea of a computer that is a helpful appliance that didn't exist. I think that the mouse was fantastic. You know, people were predicting how civilians would never touch a mouse or would never acquire the motor skills that are necessary to do it. And of course, you know, it should be really light pens that should be used, and so on and so forth. But so let me tell you 10 seconds about how WYSIWYG came about. We had a demo where we took we printed the screen. We had a nice memo with multiple fonts and all that, and we printed it on the Dover, which is on the floor, and we printed it on a transparent stock, you know, the stock that you use for slides that could be fed into a Xerox copier. So we fed the transparent stock, and we had the printout of the screen on transparent stock. And when these executives from Citibank came to visit and looked at the machine, and we printed it, and somebody went to the shared printer to pick up the output, and I held up the transparent stock in front of the screen to show that they are the same. In fact, they weren't the same at all because of the resolution, but that's neither here nor there. They were roughly the same, plus I said it was the same. No. The power of suggestion. The margins were the same, and the logo was the same. The actual words were different because of the difference in resolution, which you wanted it to be that way. But we don't going to get into that. It's the same. And so one of the executives said, and remember, this was a time of Laffin and Flip Wilson, and Flip Wilson had this tagline of had a character, a woman character.
Geraldine,
that's right. And the tagline was, what you see is what you get. And so this executive said, I see, you know, what you see is what you get. And I said, yeah, sure. You know, you are from Citibank, right? You bet. You know, displaying my newly acquired vocabulary. So you bet. Yes, sir. So that's how that happened. With the story about the last memo, I was asked about that. I know that the memo said that this machine wasn't meant to be a product. So I kind of commented to the writer of a book about that, saying that Xerox would have, if they would have found gold at Southern Mill, they would have said that this place is not meant, wasn't meant to be a gold mine. I think we should build some condominiums here.
Was the date of that memo?
78, I believe, but yeah. you could probably remember it better. So by 79, I started to look for a job, and in 80, I met this young kid called Bill Gates, and then we kind of went on from there. So thank you.
And John has the answer today. Next is Peter Doig.